Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, February 12th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, from primary care to cardiac rehabilitation, building a comprehensive heart health program for the greater Saratoga community, saratogahospital.org. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Susie Mukherjee of Albany Medical Center. She specializes in the prevention and treatment of heart disease, and she's here to answer your questions. I'm assuming that every phone will be busy. If you have a heart issue, you should probably get on the phone now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Mukherjee, your calls and much more all coming up on the Vox Pop. When? Well, right after this news. Now. Hello again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Susie Mukherjee of Albany Medical Center's Division of Cardiology. She specializes in the treatment and prevention of cardiovascular disease, particularly in women. Board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular diseases, nuclear cardiology, and echocardiography.
Sounds good.
Whatever, right? Dr. Mukherjee holds a master's degree in natural science and physiology from SUNY Buffalo and a medical degree from Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, also an active member of the American Heart Association, and is a regular keynote speaker for the Go Red for Women movement. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you so much.
You're terrific. I love it when you're on the show.
Oh, thank you.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So look, the phones are already filling up, so if you got a question, now's the time to do it. Because I'm telling you now, don't be calling me up later telling me that I was terrible and I didn't let you on. So if you get online now, each call takes a couple of minutes and then you're done. But don't be calling me up otherwise. Okay, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, ask your question.
What effects does the flu have on the heart?
Hi, Jim. Well, the flu can be problematic, honestly, in anyone who has any chronic medical condition. For heart specifically, particularly in our heart failure patients, we get concerned. That's why we ask all cardiac patients really to get the flu shot, period. When you have the flu, your whole body uses more energy, okay? Your heart rates can go up, you start to cough, you start to sneeze. It's just a lot of stress on the body. The heart may also feel that stress, particularly if your heart is already compromised. So it's really something to discuss with your cardiologist if you have a cardiac issue.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. So, okay, let's go to Sarah in Fonda. Sarah in Fonda.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi.
My husband had a small stroke a couple of months ago.
Okay.
And they also said that they believed he might have had a very minor heart attack, as indicated by tests of some kind of marker in his blood.
Okay.
And they took his blood and tested it for that.
Okay.
About once every hour, three times.
Mm-hmm.
And then said there was a downward trend in that. They found no damage with the other kinds of tests that they did on the heart muscle.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if you could talk about that marker and why, I don't know, they didn't test his blood a week later instead of just for the several hours after the stroke.
So how old is your husband, Sarah?
Mid-70s,
okay. So it's very common when somebody has an acute stroke that there's something in the blood that we measure called troponin. I'm going to assume that's what you're talking about because I don't have his medical records in front of me. But it's very common to see an elevation in that marker in the blood. Now, we usually may check a cardiac ultrasound during that time, which I'm assuming that, you know, it sounds like they may have done that when he was hospitalized. But after that troponin starts to come down, that's almost where we stop. If the heart function is normal and the troponin starts to come down, then the follow-up is usually as an outpatient. But it's very common with a stroke patient to see elevation in that. And that elevation in troponin, in some patients, yes, it's a heart attack. Sometimes that can be elevated for a variety of other reasons in a patient who's had an acute event, a stroke, or even an acute illness. So it's not the same kind of heart attack we think of where someone clutches their chest and you see it on TV and they go up to the lab and they have to put stents in. Not always. So, you know, I think of the troponin as the heart starts to sweat, and the heart can sweat in a variety of conditions, particularly a stroke. So we watch the marker, we see that it comes down, we do a cardiac ultrasound usually, and then we follow up as an outpatient. So the fact that I'm assuming that they did all this for him, and I would rest assured with that unless he has any ongoing cardiac issues.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, Doctor, one of the interesting questions that's already been raised twice now, I thought maybe you could address it just for a second, is the involvement of stroke and heart attacks. I mean, how common is it that if you have a stroke, you can naturally assume there's going to be a heart problem also?
Well, you know, it depends on the reason for the stroke. If the stroke is happening because you had a clot that went from the heart to the brain, if you had atrial fibrillation or you have a clot in the heart for another reason, then they're related. Sometimes it may look like you've had a heart attack based on that blood marker that we were just discussing,
right,
but it's not the same kind of direct heart attack, you know, that we think of when we see on TV. But yes, that abnormality in the blood work is very common to see for the heart with a stroke.
All right, we'll go to Jeff in New Paltz. Jeff in New Paltz, you're on.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello, hi. Hello, hi. Am I on?
You are indeed on. Go ahead.
Okay, wonderful. I also had a stroke in the fall. I'm 75. And they said it was atrial fibrillation, and I am now on an anticoagulant. And I'm wondering, is there any way of attacking or treating the atrial fibrillation directly rather than just thinning the blood, so avoiding a stroke?
Okay, so before you go on, doctor, tell everybody what AFib is.
Atrial fibrillation is an abnormal heart rhythm. It's a rhythm that actually originates in the top of the heart and is less, hopefully, dangerous than rhythms that originate from the bottom of the heart. Now, atrial fibrillation is very common. It's definitely treatable. And yes, you can actually make it go away. You can. In certain instances, you can. You can obtain a procedure called an atrial fibrillation ablation, where we actually go in and burn out that abnormal circuit. Now, it's not always necessary to do that. It really depends on how symptomatic you are with the AFib. A lot of patients just treat it with medication. We just want to keep the heart rate down. It's okay to stay in atrial fib if the heart rate is down. Other patients can't stand being in it, and those are patients we may actually consider doing an ablation on. If you're not looking to be on long-term blood thinners, you know, you have to, there's a lot of things to take into account for that, Jeff. You know, your age, your past medical history. The blood thinners, actually, I'm very glad to hear that you're on it because that's preventive for future stroke.
Right. So, other than the ablation, what can you also do to eliminate the AFib?
Well, one other thing you could do is actually there's something called a cardioversion where after we do certain tests, we can check to make sure that you don't have any clots in the heart and we can shock you. But there's also other medications we can use to actually try to restore the regular rhythm. That's definitely a discussion to have with your cardiologist.
Okay, so I want to ask you about this. When you do the ablation,
mm-hmm.
how do you know what to ablate
Oh, well, that's a better question for my electrophysiologist partners, but they actually map it out. They are able to do mapping. They do a lot of imaging, and they go
where
in.
Where the blood is going. In other words, where the blood is going.
Well, they look at the actual walls of the heart.
I see.
And they go along the walls, and they're able to map out where they think that abnormal circuit is coming from. And they go into the lab, and it's a beautiful, amazing system, and you can see it. And they go after them, and they burn appropriately.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay. And now we'll go to Kim in Middletown. Kim in Middletown. All right, Kim, you're on.
Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had chemotherapy last summer.
Okay.
And one of the side effects, I guess, that I've read is that it causes heart condition.
Well,
is there any way I can, is there anything I can do to, you know, lessen the heart issues?
Well, can you tell me what heart condition you have now because of the chemotherapy?
Right now, not every day, but, you know, when I get excited and something doesn't go right, I can feel my heart beating a little faster.
Well, the most common, one of the most common side effects of chemotherapy on the heart is it affects the heart muscle, and you can get what we call a cardiomyopathy, okay? So one of the things to do is to check an ultrasound of the heart to make sure that your heart muscle is still properly functioning. If it's not functioning properly, that may also be leading to abnormal heart rhythms that you may be feeling, okay? A monitor may be helpful for you in that instance. I would definitely see if you can see a cardiologist for further testing.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addictions. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Nathan Litauer Hospital, providing baby boxes to babies born in the Nathan Litauer Birthing Center, helping to provide a safe sleep environment for newborns. NLH.org. Windhorse Naturopathic Clinic, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering naturopathic medicine, oxidative medicine, colon hydrotherapy, and acupuncture. Specializing in Lyme disease, now accepting new primary care patients, windhorsenaturopathic.com. And from Innovative Therapy Solutions, LLC, Great Barrington, offering the Strength in Numbers program, a support group for families coping with a loved one's addiction. Meetings weekly, drop-ins welcome. 413-528-8888.
We are back, and we are delighted to be back. Susie, if I may call you that.
Please.
I don't mean to be disrespectful.
No, I love it. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Donna in Albany. Donna in Albany, your turn.
Hi, Donna.
Hello, doctor. What are the initial symptoms of congestive heart failure?
Well, traditionally, typically, you become very winded. You can become short of breath. You find that you're not able to lie flat in bed at night. You find that you may have a harder time going up and down a flight or two of, you know, of stairs in your home. You used to be able to walk the mall, and now you get winded very quickly and you have to sit down. Every patient's a bit different, but those kinds of symptoms, you know, may alert you to call your doctor. And ask these questions, you know. And women also, women tend to be a bit murky about things. And so you may just feel exhausted. You can't sleep. You feel that you're always trying to catch your breath. But, you know, there are things that mimic these things as well. You know, a lot of patients are coming into the hospital, you know, wondering about CHF, and then we swab them and they have one of the strains of the flu. So you have to, you know, there's a way to delineate what your shortness of breath can be or weakness. So I would definitely see your doctor if you think that you might have any of these symptoms.
And what about left arm? What about jaw?
Well, that kind of pain and those symptoms traditionally go with blockages of the arteries to the heart or heart attack symptoms, or if you're concerned that you may be developing blockages, you may notice that as you're exerting yourself, your arm starts to get numb, or that you're going up the stairs, you get chest pain. Sometimes that pain can radiate to the arm, to the, you know, up to the face, to the teeth, to the gums, to the back, down the shoulders. You know, heart failure typically implies that the heart muscle itself has become weak.
Well,
and it may not always be weak just because of a blockage. There are other things that may also contribute, like viruses in some cases. Alcohol is another reason why someone, long-standing alcoholism can also do it in some patients. The best thing is to go see a cardiologist and make sure what you have.
Okay, thank you.
You're very
welcome.
You.
You know, Susie, somebody once told me, maybe my friend Harry, but told me that if you are feeling a chest pain and you touch it, and it reacts to the touch, it ain't a heart attack.
Yeah. One of the things is if you feel like you're having chest pressure, and if you come into the office and see me and I touch you on the chest and I push with my finger and you say, ouch, or you say, yeah, that's where it is, it's very unlikely to be related to your heart. It's usually more musculoskeletal.
Right.
If you have pain when you take a deep breath in and you can feel it, usually it's not directly related to the heart. That's very true.
That's great. Let's go to Catherine in Albany. Catherine.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
We
Hi,
can.
Catherine.
Hi, great. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. My maternal grandmother had a pacemaker installed in her 70s, and then my mother did in her 60s.
Okay.
And my mother had advised me that there may be a genetic component and that it typically comes 10 years earlier with each subsequent generation.
Okay.
Truth to that, and what should I be doing about that?
Well, to be very honest, what we really need to understand is why your mother and grandmother received the pacemaker. Okay? A pacemaker is traditionally placed as, I think of it as a little friend in the body. If the heart rate drops below a certain set point, the pacemaker will kick in and pace you at a rate that's, you know, set by, you know, the machine. So pacemakers are gotten for a variety of reasons. One of the things to do is to ask them exactly why, what was their diagnosis. And if you're not having any symptoms of lightheadedness, dizziness, falling over, you feel unsteady on your feet, you know, one of the things to do is you can always discuss putting a monitor on and seeing if you have any of the heart rhythms that led to your family getting a pacemaker. Okay, it has very specific criteria. So we need to find out why they got it.
But it is amazing.
Okay.
These pacemakers are amazing, aren't they? They've really made a major difference in people's lives.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I remember Ed Koch got one and he kept it for years and years and years, maybe in New York. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So now we're gonna go, let's see here, to Mike in Saratoga. Okay, Mike in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, doctors. My question is about neurocardiogenic syncope and what the ramifications of that are going to be.
Well, I can tell you that's a pretty difficult diagnosis to even obtain.
A, and B, can you tell us what it is?
Well, it's kind of when your heart rate and your blood pressure kind of go in different directions, and they don't go in when we stand up.
Yeah.
Okay, when we stand up for a long time, usually our blood vessels kind of constrict. They bring blood back to the heart. As we walk around, our blood pressure goes up. Our heart rate follows. And neurocardiogenic syncope, a lot of the time, you know, people get dizzy and lightheaded. The heart rate can drop. And it doesn't always go the way it should, and patients feel lightheaded, dizzy, they can pass out. There are things you can do. You can wear a monitor. You can do a tilt test to help differentiate between these things. And then
I've done the tilt test, which was positive.
Yeah.
And I've done multiple Holters that have picked up on the same thing, persistent tachycardia around 130 to 160 resting, and then it plummets down to like 40.
Yes, yes. Have you talked to an electrophysiologist?
I actually was just referred to one about that.
Excellent.
But I'm just trying to figure out what's, you know, because they're talking about not being able to drive, not being able to, you know, do, you know, a majority of independent things.
Yeah, it's a different. I know, I understand, and it's like, what's going on here? Like, my whole life is going to change. But I would wait till you discuss it with him or her and figure out what, you know, if they want to try medication. Some people try a medication called a beta blocker, which is counterintuitive because sometimes those medications can lower the heart rate. But in other cases, you know, a pacemaker is not something that's traditionally used. But I would defer this really to your electrophysiologist. I'm eager for you to meet him or her.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to, Michelle in New Paltz. Okay, Michelle in New Paltz. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I have this question. I've got AFib.
Okay.
And, and I'm on a blood thinner, and my vet says that I should still. My doctor.
I thought I heard you say your vet.
Yeah, she did.
Okay.
Well, I get mixed up. My doctor's really close to where my vet is,
and sometimes
I end up taking my dog to the doctor and me to the vet.
Oh dear. Okay.
Anyway, now that I'm clear on that, I'm on a blood thinner, Eliquis, which, you know, everybody thinks is so great because of the AFib. But what I'm thinking about is, as long as I'm not having AFib, why do I have to keep taking the blood thinner? And,
Well, there are certain people who are, there's a score that we use in patients based on their age, their gender, and other historical things. The thing is, Michelle, people don't always know when they go in and out of AFib. So just because you're not in AFib today doesn't mean you can't suddenly go into AFib at a later time. There's something called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. And those patients, you know, it's better to be safe than sorry, because you don't want to stop the blood thinner and then boom, you know, you suddenly go into atrial fib, and that's when, you know, you can, shoot a clot up to the brain if there is a clot there and it wasn't bothering you because you happen to be in a normal rhythm, but you can't always predict that. There are other
way to really monitor that, like to just say, hey, I haven't been in it, or like, you know, while I'm sleeping I could go in it and then go back out,
well,
because I know that's the danger.
Well, the thing is, you can go in and out of it at any time, and if you were to put a monitor on yourself for a month, okay, we can say, oh, you didn't have it for a month, but then when you take it off, then who's watching you? Okay, there are devices that you can put in for a few years at a time. You can talk to your cardiologist about that. And there are also devices sometimes that we place in the heart. One of them is called a Watchman device. And you can talk to your cardiologist about, are you someone who may be a good candidate for that? And that may lessen your duration of needing anticoagulation.
And you wouldn't recommend, or would you recommend any other things, like taking a whole bunch of garlic and, you know,
Michelle, if you were my mother or my sister or anybody that I loved, I would say, please don't stop the Eliquis until you've talked to your cardiologist. Absolutely not. None of those things have the same benefit, proven benefit, that Eliquis does.
Thank you, Michelle. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's see here. Okay, so we will go to James in Kingston. James in Kingston, your turn. Go ahead, James.
Hi, James.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
How are you?
Hey.
I just have a quick question. It's kind of off topic a little bit, but when I was actually younger, I'm 28 right now. When I was younger, I had a disease called juvenile nasal angiofibroma, and it was benign nasal tumors.
Okay.
Ended up growing into my cranial cavity, so I had to have all sorts of surgeries.
Okay.
And one of them was angiogram.
Yes.
And during the angiogram, I actually had a stroke. And so I was just curious if in your field, if you know if any of this stuff would affect my heart or anything like that.
You know what, James? I can't lie to you. I really don't know the answer to that, if there's a direct correlation between what you had the angiogram for and if it has sequela of heart disease. I would ask your doctor or maybe see someone who specializes in that, because I don't want to give you the wrong information, and I honestly don't know.
That's a good sure. answer, James. Okay. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. I want to take a moment to ask you about something you're heavily involved in, Doctor.
Yes.
Go Red for Women.
Yes.
You want to explain that?
Well, the Go Red for Women movement came about in the 90s to really try to introduce women to the knowledge that heart disease is the number one cause of death in women. Believe it or not, the awareness is not as high as we would like it. And the American Heart Association has really spearheaded this movement. And women across the country and across the world are now becoming more aware of their heart health. And heart health can start very early. And, you know, family history and other factors certainly play a role. But we want women to look at themselves and take care of themselves. You know, women usually are caretakers of so many other people, their husbands, their children, their parents in some situations, and other people, that sometimes they have very little time or concern for themselves. So Go Red for Women, we implore women to look at their heart health and make sure that they're doing everything possible to help prevent the number one cause of death in women today.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So now we'll go to, let's see here. Judy in Poughkeepsie. Judy in Bowtown. You're on, Judy.
Okay,
hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hey, Judy, are you on some kind of a cell phone or something?
Okay, I turned my speakerphone off.
Much better.
Is that
okay.
better?
Yeah, much
yes,
better.
Yes, thank
okay,
you, Judy.
Okay, thanks. Yes. My son, who is now 35, was born with a defective aortic valve.
Okay.
He was operated on twice before he was a year old.
Mm-hmm.
And I just and at this point, and he's never, and he's been fine since.
Okay.
I mean, he gets checked up. He's obviously an adult now.
Okay.
But there's always been this specter of having to replace valves at some point. We fully expect that to happen. Now, because he's had surgery twice, I see that there's a new method where they change valves through veins.
Okay.
Now, is that something that he's likely to be able to do?
Do you remember, well, first, Judy, let me say, he's an adult, but he's still your child. So I appreciate your concern. You're still a mom, so I get that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember his diagnosis before those two surgeries when he was born?
It was aortic stenosis.
Aortic stenosis.
Severe.
Okay. So what we do in patients like this over time, I'm sure he was followed by a pediatric cardiologist for many years. Does he have an adult cardiologist now?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Yes.
So what they do is they do periodic ultrasounds to look for either stenosis, which is a tightening of the valve, or, you know, and it can be alongside leakage of that valve as well. Now, in a young person at this time, it's still preferred open heart surgery, and preferably with a metal aortic valve, because they tend to last longer. I think the valve replacement that you're referring to is something called transaortic valve replacement, transapical or transaortic, and that's done through the arterial system of the body,
okay.
and sometimes directly through the heart. And we are able to do that without having to actually, you know, go through the open rib cage. At this time, that procedure is more for older patients who are unable to or are not the proper candidate for open heart valve replacement. I can totally understand why it would seem that, oh, wait, that's the way to go. We don't have to cut his chest open. But it really depends. You know, he's 35 years old. Has he been told that he needs another valve?
He's been told that at some point you can expect to have to replace the valve.
Yeah.
Which is what we've heard his entire life.
Yes, yes.
You know, originally it was like when he hits his growth spurt in his teens, he'll obviously going to have a heart replacement, a valve replacement. But it never, you know, he's lucky he's been able to live a full life. without so right. far having that done. And yeah.
And you know what? Mm-hmm. I have several patients who have had aortic valve stenosis, and they are, you know, some of them have had replacements very young in their 20s and 30s. Some of them have had them much later. It really depends on the progression of stenosis or leakage. And if his echocardiogram every 3 to 5 years does not show any kind of damage or need to replace, they'll just keep waiting. But chances are he may need one. Then again, you know, who knows? It may be some time. I wouldn't worry about it until you actually see that the valve that he has now is not functioning properly.
Thank you, Judy. Doc, you know, there's a question I have for you, and that is, in the old days, I remember when people were doing heart valve replacements, they were using pig's hearts and mm-hmm. other things. Has all of that changed?
No. We still use pig hearts and cow hearts, but we also use metal valves as well. Metal valves tend to last a little bit longer. The problem with metal valves is, though, you have to be on long-term blood thinners. Usually older patients tend to get more of the bioprosthetic valves, we call it, which is the pig or cow valve.
Yep.
But no, we still do it.
We are going to take a very short break, and just seconds, and then we'll be back to talk to Kathy in Utica.
Support comes from Vascular Health Partners, Drs. Manish Mehta, Philip Patty, and Zachary Costin, offering personal, comprehensive, minimally invasive endovascular and vascular surgical care in 3 locations, Latham, Amsterdam, and Queensbury. VascularHealthPartners.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center, offering graduate social work degree options with flexible schedules, open house Tuesday, February 20th, 6 to 8 p.m., Poughkeepsie. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. From Penny Farthing Investment Management Amherst, a socially conscious fee-only investment advisor of personal retirement and endowment portfolios, including the Bright Penny Community Strategies, brightpenny.org. Boyden and Perrin Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services, as well as being a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. Boydenandperrin.com. And from George Heigl Antiques, Boston Spa, New York, offering estate sale services including management, appraisals, and evaluations for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974.
And we are back, and thank you so much, everybody, for being there with us. We're talking to Susie Mukherjee. She's Dr. Susie Mukherjee, of course, of Albany Medical Center's Division of Cardiology, where she specializes in treatment and prevention of cardiovascular disease, particularly in women. Okay, so let's go now to Kathy in Utica on line number 5. Kathy, you're there. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy.
Doctor,
yes.
Hi, thank
yes.
you.
Hi.
A family member mm-hmm. presented in the emergency room with florid heart failure.
Okay.
And that was our family's first inkling that this person had an alcohol addiction problem.
Mm.
He was discharged on several medications for treatment of heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
Since that crisis, this person has gone into recovery, is not drinking, but also, so the and it is of some concern, but this is an adult. He's not taking any of his cardiac medications, although he is taking a thiazide diuretic for high blood pressure. My question is this sort of alcohol-related cardiac injury reversible? Is it over with? Does he need medication?
You know, I understand. How old is this adult?
This adult is now 36.
It's now 36. Let me just first say that I can hear it in your voice how much you care and how difficult this is. For a young person, 36 is extremely young, especially in my field, to have been diagnosed with a cardiomyopathy. I applaud and support him that he has maintained, I'm hoping he's maintained sobriety. That's excellent. That's wonderful. However, he absolutely must take these medications. The medications that we give, the cocktail of medications that we give in patients with cardiomyopathy, all form, help perform a very critical function. And it's not just about the heart directly. A poor heart pump affects the rest of the body. And a lot of the medications we give help to mitigate the bad things that can happen from a heart function being poor, okay? When you said that, I have to tell you my heart sank when you said that he wasn't taking his medications. And I feel that it's a very, if I may say, somewhat foolish decision not to do that. Not drinking anymore is, yes, that's half the battle, absolutely. But damage has been done. And if this is to reverse, and it can reverse, the best chance will be if he is 100% compliant with his medications. And with time, yes, that heart muscle can improve. But he's got to take his medications. There's really no ambiguity here, Kathy.
Thank you, Kathy. All right, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now over to Patrick in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Okay, Cat Patrick, you're on.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding anticoagulation and contact sports.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, I was 27 years old. I had a minor heart attack, which later resulted in a clot in the heart and a TIA. And since that time, I've been on warfarin.
Mm.
Basically, I used to be quite active in martial arts and things like that. And I've been very lucky in that this situation hasn't affected my life much in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if there's any way to thread the needle and still take part in that, or if that is just by its nature not going to happen while I'm on anticoagulants.
Well, when was the last time you had a cardiac ultrasound?
It's been quite some time, frankly.
So I think that's the first step. You need to talk to your cardiologist. When you had a heart attack 10 years ago, and I'm making a lot of assumptions here because I don't know your case personally,
mm-hmm.
but I'm assuming that your heart muscle became quite weak and you developed a clot in the ventricle. And then maybe you had...
There's scarring in the ventricular apex.
Apex, and you developed a thrombus, which later broke off, and that's why you're on Coumadin.
Right.
Yes. So we develop clots like that in the heart wherever there's a stasis of blood flow. So if the heart pump is pumping vigorously or at least in a normal or low normal range, you won't develop a clot. The question is, you should definitely go back, see your cardiologist, have him look at your heart function. If your heart function has improved, then your chance of having another clot has come down. But he's got to look at your ultrasound. With something like this, Patrick, you've got to stay in touch with your cardiologist because he's going to be the one, or he or she will be the one to actually tell you, hey, look, now that your heart function is this and that, I still think you're at risk, or maybe now your risk is actually less and you don't even know. So don't avoid that person.
Thank you, Patrick. Yeah. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. We're coming around the curve here, and I want to get as many people in as we can. Don't hate me too much for going quick. Let's go to Katie in Saratoga. Katie, you're on.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, are you there? Hi.
Yep.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'm 35, and a little bit of background. 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with ventricular tachycardia. It's kind of idiopathic. I'm not really sure how it happened. I am under the care of an electrophysiologist. And I've had two ablations, both of which have failed. So I'm basically taking medications to control it. If I don't take it, then, I'll wake up in VT. My question is regarding pregnancy and the medications I take. I take Flecainide and Metoprolol daily. And I know that Flecainide has, I don't believe you can take that if you're pregnant. And I'm just wondering if you have what you suggest if, down the road when I decide to start a family, what do people do in my situation?
Well, I think that this is a very, it's an emotional topic. Obviously, you want to have children or you want the option to. The flecainide, yes. You don't want to be on that and try to have a baby. Don't forget that the baby, you know, first trimester especially is when the baby forms. And that's when medications, you know, a lot of, you know, we try to avoid as much medications as we can. But flecainide throughout the pregnancy is probably not a good idea. The question is going to be, you know, if you talk to your electrophysiologist and see what your options are. Now, beta blockers are pretty well tolerated in pregnancy. There's no cardiac medication that's, oh, yeah, definitely take it. But it's less, the beta blockers are more tolerated and inherently more safe than other meds.
And so, what are beta blockers, Doc?
Beta blockers are medications that actually affect the heart rate in the heart. Also has some side effects of dropping the blood pressure, does a lot of great things for abnormal rhythms in the heart, and pregnant women generally tolerate them pretty well. The question here for you, okay, Katie, though, is, and you'll have to talk to your electrophysiologist about that, I don't know if the beta blocker alone will be enough to keep you out of VT.
Right.
And I can't.
It's not enough now. You know
right,
what I mean? I
right.
have to do them both together. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. I wish I had a better answer for you. But this, you know what? I would talk to your EP doctor and tell him what you're thinking and what you're feeling, so he's in the loop and maybe, you know, making decisions with you. This is something to do together.
Thank you, Katie. Okay, now we'll go to Dave in Norwich. Okay, Dave in Norwich, you're on.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Hey, I've been to the Cleveland Clinic. I've had these heart arrhythmia, PVCs, premature ventricular contractions.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're benign. Mm-hmm. I've been out there twice, actually. And I'll go through periods of time where they're so bad, I think if my heart beats any more irregular, I'm going to die.
Oh.
And then I'll go through periods of time where it's totally normal.
Okay.
And I kind of live with it now. I'm trying to ignore it. I run about between 3.5 and 5 miles every single day. I don't smoke. I don't drink. I eat a good diet. And the last thing I had done was a cardiac MRI out in Syracuse. And Cleveland said that it was totally normal. But when I read the report, I don't have it with me. I'm sorry. I'm on the road. It said that my heart was functioning just below normal limits, which I was kind of concerned about. And I've never followed up because really difficult for me to get to Cleveland, and I haven't found a cardiologist in my area.
Okay.
I'm just concerned about, have you heard things about that? And
well,
I just don't understand why.
PVCs, premature ventricular contractions, are actually very common. Okay. They become a problem if they are sustained, like they keep happening for up to 30 seconds at a time, or if you have symptoms with them. A lot of people have them and they don't feel them. I could be having one now and I don't know. But for you, you feel them. You've had runs of them. And honestly, if you could get yourself to, we've been talking a lot about the electrical component of the heart today, but if you could see an electrophysiologist, there's something called a PVC ablation. We can actually go in there and try to find that circuit and ablate it. There's other medications.
One more thing, Doctor.
Yeah. Yes.
I did go to Syracuse before I went to the Cleveland Clinic
mm-hmm.
a few times
mm-hmm.
for an ablation. And the doctor there told me, he told me I wasn't going to remember anything on the table, but I remember it all. They went in and did the catheterization.
Okay.
Couldn't find the area where the circuit was redundant.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor told me, she said, we could guess and burn an area in your heart, but if I guess and we're wrong, we're both going to be unhappy. So I said, no guessing.
Right. Sure. Well, you know, this kind of ablation stuff is not really my subspecialty in cardiology. I would consider maybe going to an electrophysiologist at another center, or maybe looking into who does a lot of specifically PVC ablation. There's other different medications that may also help you, or different combinations of medications that may actually help suppress this. Now, as long, you know, normal heart function and a little less than normal, I'm not too concerned if it's, you know, I don't have the number in front of me and I don't have your report. You know, just a little less than normal is okay. When it's really low, heart function, heart failure patients or cardiomyopathy patients, they can have VT or PVCs, or like we were just talking about, ventricular tachycardia, because the heart is weak. It sounds like that you're just having these extra beats, which have become a great pain for you. And it sounds like you're really struggling with this. I would really either get another opinion, see another electrophysiologist, and see what they can do to try to map that out and try to get rid of it, or change your medical regimen.
Thank you, Dave. You know, Doc, a lot of people have those PVCs.
Oh, yeah.
I was struck by something you said. If you have more than 30 seconds... Of it straight.
Yeah,
okay.
Nonstop, 30 seconds. Then we start calling it ventricular tachycardia.
Interesting, interesting. Okay, now we've got a JAG in Queens.
Okay. Really?
It says JAG, J-A-G in Queens. All right, number three. Here you go.
Hi, JAG.
Good afternoon, Dr. G.
Hi.
Well, I have a girlfriend.
Okay.
And she's as stubborn as possible. You know how Indian people can be. And she has these, you know, pains starting from her chest, which travel to her right side and end up going to her back.
Okay.
And, you know, when I was feeling the pain, she said it was actually near the spine, I'd say top right. And you know, she's not going to the doctor. She finally booked a, you know, an appointment with the cardiologist. But I was wondering how that pain travels. And then also she said her jaw started hurting a little bit.
How old is your girlfriend, Jack?
She's 22 years old.
Oh, so she's young.
23, sorry. Yeah, she's young. So that's the scary part.
No. She's 23 or 43?
23.
Okay, she's 23. And what ethnicity did you say she was?
She's Indian.
So I'm glad, you know, I'm actually glad that we brought this up because South Asians tend to have a lot of inherent heart disease at very young age. That's something that's very ethnically based as well. But what we have on our side is her youth. 23 is pretty young to be concerned about a significant amount of blockage. Now, that doesn't mean that I, without examining her, without seeing her, and, you know, women, we're murky. We don't always present the same classic way. So typically we think of, oh, it's the left side of my chest, it goes down my left arm, or it might go to my jaw. You know, her symptoms, you know, from what you are describing, I can't say, that's definitely classic heart disease. She needs to see the cardiologist. They may or may not end up doing a stress test on her, but you can't just pinpoint and say, well, it's not this because you don't have that. People aren't that black and white, you know. So we have to look at the patient and do things individually.
Thanks, Jack from Queens. Now we'll go to Aman in Long Island. Okay, Aman, you're on.
Hi, Aman.
Well, Aman is no longer on.
Bye, Aman.
Aman chickened out.
Okay,
so now we will go to Kathy in Amherst. I love Amherst. Go ahead, Kathy, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about lipid guidelines now and target LDLs, because that changed. There used to be target LDLs, and then they went back to, you know, just go on a statin or not, you know, one or the other. So what is the new guidelines around lipid targets or lipid control?
Well, Kathy, you know, to be honest, the general answer is, you know, we like to see an LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, under 100. But you're talking to someone, me personally as a cardiologist, you know, I love lipid stuff, and I tend to be pretty aggressive of trying to get the lipid, the LDL particularly, as low as we can do it. It depends on a lot of your other risk factors. In diabetics, we want to drive it down more. If you've had heart disease, we want to drive it down more. You know, in my personal humble opinion, I think the lower the LDL, the better. I'm a big statin proponent. I think statins have changed the landscape of how people are surviving heart disease and preventive cardiology. I think they are not the enemy. They're our friends. So it depends on your personal background. Generalities are easy.
Profile of low, medium, but
it really depends on who you are, and your family history matters too.
Yes.
And that's very important. We can't ignore that. So we have to, you know, paint a picture for you using a variety of different questions to answer. But, you know, general guidelines apply to the general population. You know, I treat my patients a little bit more individually based on their own personal risk factors.
Thank you very much, Kathy in Amherst. Okay, now look, here's what. We're going to go to Scott in Plattsburgh, but Scott, here's the bad news. We only have a minute. Go ahead. You got to ask it in half a minute.
Hi, Scott.
Thank you, and thanks for all you guys do there at the radio station. I'm calling. I'm 45 years old, Caucasian, and I have been on Lipitor for a few years because of high cholesterol.
Okay.
And my father has, you know, bad heart disease. He's had carotid surgeries and then open heart surgery.
Okay, so Scott, you got to ask the question. What's the question?
How can you know where you are at in your progression of plaque buildup without waiting till you have a heart attack? I know you have heart catheterizations, but is there anything less invasive?
Okay, Doc, it's got to be a very short answer.
You know what? The fact that you're taking Lipitor is one of the best things that you're doing. You can look at your fasting lipids, look at your numbers. There's something called a calcium score you can discuss with your primary care physician, but the best thing to do is diet and continue that statin.
Thank you, Scott. Sorry to give you the rush. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, that's it. We have an apology to make to Lynn and Colony. And Bob in Albany. Lynn wanted to know very quickly, calcium score. What should a calcium score be? That's a test, right?
That's a test. Yes. That's a test. It's a CAT scan that we do. It actually gives you an idea of how much calcium is in the arteries of the heart. Zero is normal, technically. And it can have some help in predicting your 10-year risk of having an event. Yeah. There are good and bad points of it, but that's something to discuss with your doctor.
Okay, again, Lynn and Bob in Albany, we do apologize. We're out of time. My apologies to those two. I want to thank Susie Mukherjee of Albany Medical Center.
Thank you for having me.
Doctor, thank you so much for being with us. It's great when you're here.
I loved it. Thank you.
Support for Medical Monday comes from WMC Heart and Vascular Institute with new diagnostic cardiology suites at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital and Health Alliance Hospitals, members of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, WMCHealth.org. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for a news update.